the memory of a loved one, or the wisdom in a saying. Open to feelings and sensations related to this refuge. Get a sense of having a refuge, and stay with this experience and let it in. Try naming the refuge to yourself, such as, I take refuge in something. See how this feels and allow the sense of refuge to grow inside you. Try this naming with other refuges. Explore relating to a refuge not as something over there that is separate from you, but rather as something already present in you. You could say to yourself things like, may I come from something, or I'm abiding as something, or may I be uplifted by something. Regarded in this way, a refuge can feel like a wholesome, beneficial current carrying you along. Try taking refuge in gratitude. In the feeling of being liked by people who do care about you. In the sense of your kindness and decency. In anything else you want. Give over to your refuges. Let them live you. Let be, let go, let in. Clinical psychology, coaching, human resources trainings, personal growth workshops, and the world's contemplative traditions offer many different ways to be happy, loving, effective, and wise. But for all the variety in these approaches and methods, they cluster into three groups, three major ways to engage your mind. First, you can be with what's there. Feel the feelings, experience the experience, the bitter as well as the sweet. You could explore an experience's different aspects, such as the sensations in it, as well as emotions, thoughts, and desires, and perhaps sense down to more vulnerable material, like the hurt often found beneath anger. In the process of being with it, an experience might change, but you are not deliberately trying to change it. Second, you can decrease the negative, whatever is painful or harmful, by preventing, reducing, or ending it. For example, you could vent feelings to a friend, step away from self-critical thoughts, stop bringing home cookies that fuel desires for sugar, or ease tension by relaxing your body. Third, you can increase the positive, whatever is enjoyable or beneficial, by creating, growing, or preserving it. You could breathe more quickly to lift your energy, remember times with friends that make you feel happy, have realistic and useful thoughts about a situation at work, or motivate yourself by imagining how good it will feel to eat healthy foods. In other words, getting good at coping, healing, and well-being is a matter of getting good at letting be, letting go, and letting in. Mindfulness is necessary for all of these, since we can't let be, let go, or let in without it. Also, these ways to practice with the mind work together. For example, you could use the third one, increasing the positive, to grow an inner resource such as self-compassion in order to be with difficult feelings. Imagine that your mind is a garden. You can tend to it in three ways: observe it, pull weeds, and plant flowers. Observing it is fundamental, and sometimes that's all you can do. Perhaps something terrible has happened and you can only ride out the storm. But being with the mind is not enough. We must work with it as well. The mind is grounded in the brain, which is a physical system that doesn't change for the better on its own. Weeds don't get pulled and flowers don't get planted simply by watching the garden. moving through an upset. The three ways to engage the mind provide a step-by-step roadmap for moving through an upset. Suppose you feel stressed, hurt, or angry. Start by being with whatever is happening inside you. Tune into your body, perhaps your chest tightening or a sinking feeling in your stomach. Explore your emotions, thoughts, and desires. Also look for what might be deeper and more vulnerable, such as the pain of a recent breakup beneath worries about dating again. Try to accept your experience as it is without resisting it, even if it's uncomfortable. Be on your own side and have compassion for yourself. Second, when it feels right, move into letting go. Take a few breaths while exhaling slowly and let any tension drain out of your body. As appropriate, you can release emotions by venting to a friend, yelling in the shower, crying, or imagining a river of light pouring through you and washing away any sad or upsetting feelings. Pull your attention away from negative thought loops. Challenge beliefs that are exaggerated or untrue by thinking of reasons why they're wrong. Try to see the big picture. Whatever has happened is probably a short chapter in the long book of your life. Know how a problematic desire, such as wanting to lash out in anger, could hurt you or others. Imagine holding that desire in your hand like a stone and then dropping it. Third, when you're ready, shift to letting in. Recognize that you've come through something hard and appreciate yourself for doing so. Let easing and relaxing spread through your body. Notice or bring to mind feelings that are natural replacements for what you have released, such as reassurance spreading inside as anxiety leaves. Focus on thoughts that are accurate and useful, replacing those that are wrong and harmful. See if there are any lessons to learn, such as ways to be kinder to yourself or more effective with others. Decide if there is anything to do differently from now on, such as leaving earlier for the airport or not talking about money with your partner right before going to sleep. Trust your intuition about when to move from one step to the next. It's like the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, in which one bed was too hard, one was too soft, and one was just right. What feels just right will depend on the experience itself. For example, you could be with a judgmental thought for a few seconds and recognize its familiar yapping. Oh, there it is again, ranting about how others drive. And then shift quickly to letting go. There is no value in listening to it rattle on and on. You already got the message, so you hang up the phone. But sometimes things are really hard, and the most you can do is simply bear them. Perhaps your partner has died, and it takes years to move through the first and second steps, letting be and letting go, before you can even imagine letting someone else into your heart. Other people may want to hurry you along, but go at your own pace. Maybe all you can do is touch the pain for a few seconds, and then you need to back away from it for a while before being with it again. Personally, I entered adulthood with a big bucket of tears deep inside. Feeling it all at once would have been overwhelming, so I've gradually emptied it one spoonful at a time. If you try to let go and let in, but find that it feels superficial or inauthentic, go back to the first step and be with your mind. Explore what else is there to experience fully, perhaps something softer and younger. The process of letting be, letting go, and letting in can sometimes uncover the next layer of psychological material. Then you can use the three steps to move through that layer, and perhaps additional layers, in a deepening spiral. Stay mindful, and you'll be pulling weeds, planting flowers, and getting to know your garden better all along the way. Take care of your needs. Soon after Forrest was born, my parents came to visit, and my mother was excited to hold her first grandchild. She perched him on her chest, close to her face, and bubbled away. Oh, what a sweet baby! What a good baby you are! But he couldn't hold up his head to look at her, and he started fussing. My mother kept talking to him while he became more and more upset. I murmured, Mom, I think he wants you to hold him to the side so he's more comfortable. She said happily, he doesn't know what he wants. Startled, I said he did want to be held differently since he'd been fine until she picked him up. She replied with cheerful gusto, oh, who cares what he wants? I muttered that I did and retrieved our son. There's a lot in this story. My mother was a very loving person and ecstatic about seeing Forrest. She was just expressing two beliefs that had guided how she was brought up. Children are not really beings who know what they want, and even if they do, their wants don't matter much compared to those of adults. Realistically, no child or adult can have every want satisfied every time. Nor should they, since some desires are harmful. Still, at the bottom of every want is a healthy need. My mom needed to feel close to her family. She needed to give love and have it received. She needed to feel that she mattered and was respected. These are completely normal needs. Excited to see us and raised in a certain way herself, she went about meeting her needs in ways that were problematic, unskillful with a baby, and insensitive to her son and daughter-in-law. But her underlying intentions were good. Needs and wants blur together, and what is a need to one person could be a want to someone else, so I'm not going to draw a sharp line between them. Every living creature, including a big complicated human one, is motivated to pursue its wants and satisfy its needs. Wanting is inescapable. Consequently, a deepening awareness of your wants and needs, and your thoughts and feelings about them, can help you meet them more effectively and accept yourself more fully. Learning about wanting. Be mindful of your experiences related to wanting. These experiences include preferring one thing over another, pursuing a goal, making a request, and insisting on something. In particular, notice how you're affected by the reactions of others to your wants and needs. If they're supportive, that probably feels good. But if they ignore, dismiss, or thwart you, it's natural to feel that your wants and needs don't matter, and could in fact be embarrassing, even disgusting, and, by extension, that you don't matter, and that there could be something wrong with you, something you ought to suppress and hide. The residues of these and other experiences are stored in the brain as emotional, social, and somatic learning. This begins when we are very young and very dependent on others to read our wants and needs accurately and respond to them kindly and effectively. We learn about wanting itself, which wants are allowed and can be pursued directly, which ones are supposed to be camouflaged and sought covertly, and which ones are considered shameful and must be denied. With mindfulness, you can look inside and understand yourself better. Take a little time and explore the answers to these questions. How did your parents respond to your wants? What did you learn about wanting while growing up? As an adult, how have others responded to your wants? In what ways have you been supported? In what ways have your wants been ignored, criticized, or defeated? How have you felt about all this? How has your past affected how you go about meeting your wants and needs these days? For example, have you been embarrassed about some of the things you want? Reflecting on all this, are there any changes you'd like to make? Perhaps you could be more open about something you want, or more straightforward about seeking it. Your three needs. Mindfulness of your past helps you to know yourself better in the present and to be more effective at taking care of your needs in the future. So, what do you need? Psychological theories classify needs in various ways. As a summary of these ideas, I've categorized them into three basic needs. One, we need safety, from raw survival to knowing we won't be attacked if we speak up. We fulfill this need by avoiding harms, such as not touching a hot stove or steering clear of certain people. Two, we need satisfaction, from having enough to eat to feeling that life is worth living. We handle this by approaching rewards, such as smelling the roses, finishing the laundry, or building a business. 3, we need connection, from expressing sexuality to feeling worthy and loved. We take care of this need by attaching to others, such as by texting a friend, feeling understood, or giving compassion. Every animal species, including human beings, needs its version of safety, satisfaction, and connection. These basic needs are grounded in life itself, and how we manage them today is based on the evolution of the nervous system over the past 600 million years. To simplify a long, complex process, the brain has been built from the bottom up, like a house with 3 floors. In the house of the brain, the first and oldest floor is the brainstem, developed during the reptilian stage of evolution, with a focus on safety. In its essence, the most fundamental need of all, to stay alive. The second floor is the subcortex, which contains the hypothalamus, thalamus, amygdala, hippocampus, and basal ganglia. This part of your brain has taken shape during the mammalian phase of evolution, which began around 200 million years ago. The subcortex helps us be more effective in pursuing satisfaction. The top floor is the neocortex, which started expanding with the first primates about 50 million years ago. It has tripled in volume since early hominids began manufacturing tools 2.5 million years ago. The neocortex has enabled humans to be the most social species on the planet. It is the neural basis of empathy, language, cooperative planning, and compassion, sophisticated ways to meet our needs for connection. In a sense, we're walking around with a zoo inside our heads. Solutions to life or death problems faced by our ancient ancestors while swimming in dark oceans, hiding from dinosaurs, or fighting with other Stone Age bands are built into the brain today. While the parts of the brain work together to meet our needs, they do have specialized functions shaped by our evolutionary history. To push the metaphor, it's as if we each have an inner lizard freezing or fleeing from danger, a mouse sniffing about for cheese, and a monkey looking for its tribe. Embracing your needs. It can feel embarrassing to admit that you have needs. A country or culture may value rugged independence, but the reality is that we all depend on many things for survival, success, and happiness, from the air we breathe to the kindness of strangers to the infrastructure of civilization. Real ruggedness is being brave enough to admit the fact of ordinary human neediness. A healthy body and mind do not come from denying, overcoming, or transcending needs. They are instead the natural result of taking care of your needs and being mindful of the needs of others. Consequently, it's the needs we push away that are often the most important to embrace. So try to be aware of needs or aspects of needs that have been unmet. Listen to the longings of your heart. As you go through your day, be mindful of your needs for safety. Notice when you feel uneasy, irritated, or overwhelmed. See if any beliefs are making you anxious that may not actually be true. When it feels right, shift into letting go and letting in, such as finding refuges and settling as best you can into a place of peace. Or your need for satisfaction. Be aware of any feelings of boredom, disappointment, frustration, or loss. After you've explored this experience, you could think of things you're grateful for or glad about. See if you can find a sense of contentment. And your need for connection. Notice when you feel hurt, resentment, envy, loneliness, or inadequacy. Then recall times when you felt cared about, and times when you felt friendly or caring yourself. Rest in love flowing in and flowing out. Responding or reacting. Life challenges our needs all the time. but we can experience that our needs are met even as we take practical steps to cope with intense challenges. For example, as a rock climber, I've been in many dangerous places, standing on little edges the width of a pencil with a long fall if I slipped. My need for safety was definitely challenged at these times, but inside, I almost always felt completely safe. I'd climbed a lot and felt comfortable doing it, and knew I was tied to a rope with a capable partner holding the other end. I was on high alert, cautious and wary, dealing with intense threats, and usually having the time of my life. You probably have your own examples of managing and even enjoying very challenging activities or situations. Life is turbulent and unpredictable, containing wonderful opportunities that still take a lot of work, and inevitable losses and pains. We can't avoid challenges. The only question is how we deal with them. There is a fundamental difference between facing challenges while experiencing that your needs are being sufficiently met and facing challenges while experiencing that your needs are not being met. Green zone, red zone. When we experience that needs are sufficiently met, there is a sense of fullness and balance. The body and mind default to their resting state, which I call the responsive mode, or green zone. The body conserves its resources, refuels and repairs itself, and recovers from stress. In the mind, there is a sense of peace, contentment, and love, broad umbrella terms related to our needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection. This is embodied well-being. On the other hand, when we experience that a need is unmet, there is a sense of deficit and disturbance, something missing, something wrong. The body and the mind are agitated out of their resting state into the reactive mode, or red zone. The body fires up into fight, flight, or freeze reactions, shaking up its immune, hormonal, cardiovascular, and digestive systems. In the mind, there is a sense of fear, frustration, and hurt, umbrella terms related to our needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection. This is stress, distress, and dysfunction. The distinction between the responsive and reactive modes is inherently fuzzy. Still, we all know the difference between feeling capable and confident while handling a challenge or feeling rattled and worried. Here is a summary of these two modes for each one of our three needs. Meeting our needs. When we meet the need for safety from the responsive mode, there is a sense of peace, but when we meet it from the reactive mode, there is a sense of fear. For our need for satisfaction, we meet it by approaching rewards. The portion of the brain that is associated with it is the subcortex, linked to the mammalian stage of evolution. When we meet this need from the responsive mode, there is a sense of contentment, but when we meet it from the reactive mode, there is a sense of frustration. And last, for our need for connection, we meet it by attaching to others. In the brain, this need is most associated with the neocortex, which is linked to the primate human stage of evolution. When we meet the need for connection from the responsive mode, there is a sense of love, but when we meet it from the reactive mode, there is a sense of hurt. It's possible to experience that one basic need is unmet, while the other two are doing fine. For example, two parents could feel emotionally disconnected from their rebellious adolescent, while at the same time knowing that they are all physically safe and able to pursue opportunities for rewards in other areas. When one need goes red, while the others stay green, then reactions to the unmet need can spread to involve other needs. In this example, the parents might start to feel anxious about the teenager's safety and frustrated about the goal of getting their child through high school. Alternately, feeling resourced in other areas can help address a particular need that's blinking red. The parents here could draw on a sense of their commitment to the teen's safety and the knowledge that they do have effective ways to satisfy the requirements of high school. Sometimes all you can do is preserve a tiny little green refuge in yourself that stays calm and strong while the rest of you is upset. But the sense of that small sanctuary makes a great difference, and with time you can gradually move out from it to ease and take care of the rest of your mind. The responsive and reactive modes are not just the result of experiencing that needs are met or unmet. They are also two different ways to meet our needs. To borrow an example from Robert Sapolsky's book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, imagine being a zebra in a large herd in Africa. You're eating grass, keeping a watchful eye out for lions, but staying calm, interacting with other zebras, and enjoying yourself as you handle your needs from the responsive mode. Suddenly, some lions attack, and your herd bursts into a reactive mode flight of panicky activity that ends quickly, one way or another. And then you and the other zebras return to responsive ways of handling life on the savannah. In a nutshell, this is Mother Nature's blueprint. Long periods of responsive mode management of needs, punctuated by occasional spikes when necessary of reactive mode stress, followed by rapid recovery back to the green zone. The responsive mode feels good because it is good. The body is protected and replenished, and the mind is at ease and content. On the other hand, the reactive mode feels bad because it is bad, especially over the long run. The body becomes disturbed and depleted, and the mind becomes occupied by anxiety, irritation, disappointment, hurt, and resentment. The reactive mode tears us down, while the responsive mode builds us up. Adversity is certainly an opportunity to develop resilience, stress hardiness, and even post-traumatic growth. But for a person to grow through adversity, there must also be responsive resources present, such as determination and sense of purpose. Plus, most opportunities in daily life to experience and develop mental resources do not involve adversity. There is simply a moment of relaxation, gratitude, enthusiasm, self-worth, or kindness. Meanwhile, most moments of fear, frustration, or hurt are simply unpleasant and stressful, with no benefit left behind. Adversity is to be faced and learned from, but I think people sometimes overrate its value. On the whole, reactive experiences make us more brittle and fragile over time, while responsive experiences tend to make us more resilient. The reactive mode evolved to be a brief solution to immediate threats to survival, not a way of life. Unfortunately, while we're no longer running from saber-toothed tigers, our modern multitasking, racing about, and frequent stresses keep pushing us into the red zone. Then it's hard to leave, due to what researchers call the brain's negativity bias. The negativity bias. Our ancestors needed to gain quote-unquote carrots, such as food and sex, and to escape from quote-unquote sticks, such as predators, and aggression inside or between their bands. Both are important, but sticks usually have more urgency and impact for survival. Back on the Serengeti Plains, if you failed to get a carrot, you'd still have a chance to get another one. But if you failed to avoid a stick, whack, no more carrots forever. As a result, the brain naturally and routinely 1. Scans for bad news out in the world and inside the body and mind. 2. Focuses tightly on it, losing sight of the big picture. 3. Overreacts to it. 4. Fast tracks the experience into emotional, somatic, and social memory. And 5. Becomes sensitized through repeated doses of the stress hormone cortisol, so it becomes even more reactive to negative experiences, which bathes the brain in even more cortisol, creating a vicious cycle. In effect, our brains are like Velcro for bad experiences, but Teflon for good ones. For example, if 10 things happen to you during a day at work or in a relationship, and 9 of them are positive while 1 is negative, what do you tend to think about most? Probably the negative one. Pleasant, useful, beneficial experiences happen many times a day. enjoying a cup of coffee, getting something done at home or work, snuggling into bed with a good book at night. But they ordinarily pass through the brain like water through a sieve, while each stressful or harmful experience gets stuck to it. We're designed to overlearn from bad experiences while underlearning from good ones. The negativity bias made sense for survival over millions of years of evolution, but today it's a kind of universal learning disability in a brain designed for peak performance under Stone Age conditions. The effects of this bias are worsened by the recent evolution of neural networks in the midline of the cortex that enable mental time travel, reflecting on the past and planning for the future. These networks also enable negative rumination. Unlike our animal cousins who learn from their close calls but don't obsess about them, we tend to keep going over worries, resentments, and self-criticism. So many things could go wrong. How dare they treat me that way? I am such an idiot. The thoughts and feelings we have while ruminating change the brain just as other negative experiences do. Running these loops repeatedly is like running laps in soft dirt, deepening the track each time we go around it, which makes it easier to fall into negative rumination in the future. Coming home, staying home. To sum it up, we have no choice about our three needs, or how the reptilian, mammalian, primate stages of evolution have shaped the ways that the brain tries to meet our needs. Our only choice is how we meet our needs, from the green zone or the red zone, with an underlying sense of peace, contentment, and love, or with a sense of fear, frustration, or hurt. The responsive mode is our home base, a healthy equilibrium of body and mind. It's the essence of well-being and the basis of sustained resilience. But we're easily driven from that home and into the red zone. Then it's easy to get stuck there due to the negativity bias and negative rumination in a kind of chronic inner homelessness. It's not our fault we're like this. It's our biological endowment, a gift of sorts from Mother Nature. But there is a lot we can do about it. Leave the red zone. Sometimes it's necessary to meet challenges in reactive ways. Maybe you have to dodge a car coming at you, or fire up to deal with someone who's getting way too aggressive. Humans are tough, and we can tolerate trips to the red zone, but leave it as soon as you can. The three ways of engaging the mind provide a good blueprint for doing this. Let be. Be mindful of when you are starting to feel pressured, uneasy, exasperated, frustrated, stressed, or upset. Be with the experience and explore its different parts. Label them to yourself, such as tense, worried, annoyed, sad. This labeling will increase activity in the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain behind your forehead, which will help with top-down self-control. Naming to yourself what you are experiencing will also decrease activity in the amygdala, which functions like an alarm bell in the brain, and help you calm down. Explore what might be vulnerable and soft deeper down, such as sad feelings of being left out in high school, beneath a flare of anger at not being included in a meeting at work. Simply be with what is flowing through awareness without rehashing it or working up a righteous case about it. Step back from red zone reactions and observe them, like stepping out of a movie and moving 20 rows back in the theater to watch it. Let go. Shift into letting go. Understand that reactive thoughts and feelings are generally not good for you, and others as well. Decide whether you want to hold on to these thoughts and feelings or release them. Exhale slowly and relax your body. Let feelings flow. As appropriate, cry, yell, grumble with a sympathetic friend, or simply sense that anxiety, irritation, and hurt are draining out of you. Be skeptical of the assumptions, expectations, or beliefs that made you worried, stressed, frustrated, or angry. Consider the meanings you gave to situations or how you interpreted the intentions of others and let go of whatever is untrue, needlessly alarmist, or mean-spirited. Be mindful of the sense of leaving the reactive mode. Let in. Start letting in whatever helps you feel that your needs are being met. Tune into a sense of determination and capability inside. Give yourself some pleasure. Wash your hands in warm water, eat an apple, or listen to music. Pleasure releases natural opioids that soothe and settle the brain's stress machinery. Think of things you feel grateful for or glad about, things that bring a little smile. Connect with someone you like, either directly or in your imagination. Let yourself feel cared about. Also, recognize your own warm heart. Identify thoughts or perspectives that are accurate, useful, and wise. Be mindful of the sense of entering the responsive mode. Build up responsive resources. Most people experience the responsive mode many times a day, but usually blow right by it before it has a chance to sink in. So look for opportunities to feel like your needs are being met. For example, while inhaling, notice that there is plenty of air to breathe. At least in this moment, you are safe enough, moment after moment after moment. As you finish one task or another, an email sent, a child's hair brushed, a car's gas tank filled up, stay with a sense of satisfaction. When someone smiles at you, or you remember a person you love, keep feeling connected. Be mindful of green zone experiences, value them, and stay with them. Let them into yourself, taking half a dozen seconds or longer to help them begin hardwiring their way into your brain. In this way, you'll be developing inside yourself the underlying fullness and balance that are the basis of the responsive mode. You'll also be gradually reducing the sense of deficit and disturbance that triggers the reactive mode. Internalizing green zone experiences builds up a core of inner strengths. In a positive cycle, this fosters more experiences of the responsive mode, and therefore more opportunities to grow inner resources. Then you can handle larger and larger challenges, staying green inside even when the world is flashing red, with a bone-deep, resilient well-being that nothing can penetrate and overwhelm. When faced with a challenge, be mindful of which particular need, for safety, satisfaction, or connection, is at stake. Deliberately call upon your inner strengths related to meeting these specific needs. And I'll be showing you many ways to do this in the chapters ahead. Then, as you experience mental resources, you can reinforce them in your nervous system. I've sailed some, and I've managed to capsize a boat that didn't have a keel. If the mind is like a sailboat, growing inner resources is like strengthening and lengthening its keel. Then you can live more boldly, trusting that you can explore and enjoy the deeper waters of life and handle any storms that come your way. Key points. Your brain is shaped by your experiences, which are shaped by what you attend to. With mindfulness, you can rest your attention on experiences of psychological resources such as compassion and gratitude, and hardwire them into your nervous system. There are three major ways to relate to and engage the mind usefully. Be with it, decrease what is painful and harmful, and increase what is enjoyable and beneficial. We have three basic needs, safety, satisfaction, and connection, that we manage by avoiding harms, approaching rewards, and attaching to others. These needs and the ways we meet them are loosely related, respectively, to the reptilian brainstem, mammalian subcortex, and primate-human neocortex. Well-being comes from meeting our needs, not denying them. When we experience that our needs are sufficiently met, the body and mind enter the green zone responsive mode, and there is a sense of peace, contentment, and love. When needs feel unmet, we are disturbed into the fight, flight, freeze, red zone reactive mode, and there is a sense of fear, frustration, or hurt. The responsive mode is our home base, but we're easily driven from home and prone to getting stuck in the red zone due to the brain's negativity bias, which makes it like Velcro for bad experiences, but Teflon for good ones. To stay in the green zone, take in experiences of your needs being met, which will grow inner resources. Then you can handle larger and larger challenges with resilient well-being. Chapter 3. Learning. Think not lightly of good, saying, "It will not come to me." Drop by drop is the water pot filled. Likewise, the wise one, gathering it little by little, fills oneself with good. The Dhammapada. Going on a long hike, we need to bring food and other supplies. Similarly, on the road of life, we need psychological supplies such as compassion and courage. How do we get these supplies into the neural backpack? The growth curve. We do it by learning. This is a broad term that goes far beyond memorizing multiplication tables. Any lasting change of mood, outlook, or behavior requires learning. From childhood onward, we learn good habits, character strengths, and skillful ways to interact with others. Healing, recovery, and development are forms of learning as well. About a third of our attributes are innate in our DNA, while the other two-thirds are acquired through learning. This is very good news, since it means we have great influence over who we become, who we learn to be. Suppose you would like to be calmer, wiser, happier, and more resilient. Having read many comic books as a kid, I think of these inner strengths as sort of like superpowers. Learning is the superpower of superpowers, the one that grows the rest of them. If you want to steepen your growth curve in life, it pays to learn about learning. How learning happens. Any kind of learning involves a change in neural structure or function. These changes occur in two stages, which I call activation and installation. In the first stage, activation, there is an experience such as feeling liked. All experiences, all thoughts, sensations, daydreams, worries, and anything else passing through awareness are based on underlying neural processes. A particular experience is a particular state of mental neural activity. Then, in the second stage, installation, this experience is gradually consolidated in long-term storage in the brain. Over time, passing states become installed as lasting traits. By the way, I'm using the term trait broadly. There's a saying in brain science based on the work of Donald Hebb: neurons that fire together wire together. The more they fire together, the more they wire together. In essence, you develop psychological resources by having sustained and repeated experiences of them that are turned into durable changes in your brain. You become more grateful, confident, or determined by repeatedly installing experiences of gratitude, confidence, or determination. Similarly, you center yourself increasingly in the responsive green zone with an underlying sense of peace, contentment, and love by having and internalizing many experiences of safety, satisfaction, and connection. The essence of self-reliance. This is the fundamental how-to of healing, training, and personal growth. You can apply it to developing interpersonal skills, motivation, peace of mind, or anything else you want inside yourself. It's the essence of self-reliance. Even the most fulfilling situations, occupations, and relationships may change. Sooner or later, one way or another, the bottom could fall out. But whatever you have inside yourself is with you always. Just like you can't unlearn how to ride a bicycle, you won't unlearn the inner strengths you grow over time. And the harder your life is and the less support you're getting from external sources, the more important it is to look for those little opportunities each day to highlight a useful or enjoyable experience and consciously take it into yourself. Unfortunately, this process of deliberately internalizing beneficial experiences is rarely taught explicitly. In schools, workplaces, and trainings, people are instructed in various things, but they're not usually taught how to learn. When you learn how to learn, you gain the strength that builds the other strengths of resilient well-being. Heal yourself. You can guide the structure-building processes of your brain in four steps, which I summarize with the acronym HEAL, H-E-A-L. In the first stage, activation, step one, have a beneficial experience. Notice it or create it. In the second stage, installation, two, enrich it. Stay with it, feeling it fully. Three, absorb it. Receive it into yourself. Four, link it, optional. Use it to soothe and replace painful, harmful psychological material. The first step of heal is the activation phase of learning. You start with a useful or enjoyable experience of some kind. The rest of heal is the installation phase, in which you begin the process of turning that beneficial experience into a lasting change in your brain. The fourth step, link, involves being aware of positive and negative material at the same time. It is optional for two reasons. The first three steps alone are sufficient for learning, and sometimes people are not yet ready to engage their negative material. In the rest of this chapter, we'll explore the heal steps in detail, including how to have beneficial experiences more often, and then help them have enduring value. I'll show you how to identify and grow the strengths you need most, and you'll see how to use the link step to ease and even end difficult, upsetting, or limiting thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, including from childhood. Encourage beneficial experiences. Ask yourself what stands out in a typical day. The car that cut you off, the dish that broke, and the frustrating project at work? Or the pleasure of eating breakfast, the sense of determination as you push through a difficult task, and the beauty of a sunset. Think about your relationships. What draws your attention when you're interacting with others? The many things going well, or the one word that stings? If you're like most people, it's the negative that stands out. Because of the brain's negativity bias, painful and harmful experiences move to the front of awareness, while enjoyable and useful ones fade into the background. This may have short-term benefits in harsh conditions, but over time it causes much wear and tear on your body and mind. In effect, the brain is tilted toward survival, but against long-term health and well-being. By tilting back toward positive experiences, you just level the playing field. This is not about wearing rose-colored glasses or looking on the bright side. It's hard-headed pragmatism based on recognizing that life is often difficult, you need mental resources for it, and you can build these inner strengths by guiding your brain's learning process. This process starts with experiencing the good you want to grow inside yourself. There are two ways to have a beneficial experience. First, you can simply notice and focus on one that you are already having. Second, you can deliberately create an experience, such as calling up a feeling of self-compassion or sitting down to meditate. Let's explore each of these. See the jewels around you. Nearly everyone has many positive experiences each day, most of them mild and brief. For example, it feels good to drink water if you're thirsty, or put on a sweater if you're chilled. It's hard to get through a day without feeling friendly toward at least one person. Do you take notice of these experiences and highlight them in your awareness? Or do you pass by them and just move on to the next thing? Each day is like a path strewn with many little jewels, the small, ordinary, beneficial experiences of life. It's easy to overlook these and step right over them. But then we get to the end of the day and ask, why don't I feel richer inside? Why does it feel like I'm running on empty? The jewels are already there. Why not pick some of them up? If an experience feels good, it usually is good for you, and often for others too. Don't dismiss enjoyable experiences as lightweight and trivial, and don't think that grinding, wearying, stressful experiences are somehow the foundation of a good life. It's the opposite. Positive experiences fill us up, while negative ones wear us down. Sure, some pleasures are bad for a person over time, such as eating too many sweets. And some psychological resources are grown in part through unpleasant experiences. For example, you can strengthen your moral compass through appropriate guilt and remorse. But on the whole, if something feels good, that's usually a sign it's a jewel worth reaching for. Our experiences are built from five elements, and each element is a type of jewel you can weave into the fabric of your brain and your life. These elements are thoughts, such as beliefs or images, perceptions, such as sensations or sounds, emotions, such as feelings or moods, desires, such as values or intentions, and actions, such as the sense of posture, facial expressions, movement, and behavior. For example, in an experience of gratitude, there could be a thought of something a friend gave you, a perception of relaxation, an emotion of gladness, a desire to express appreciation, and an action of writing a thank you note. While you are having a beneficial experience, other things could be in awareness as well. Your back might be aching as you enjoy stroking the fur of a cat in your lap. These other things do not cancel out the beneficial experience. Both are true, the negative and the positive, the bitter and the sweet. You can let the bad be, while also letting in the good. This is not positive thinking. It's realistic thinking, seeing the whole mosaic of the world around you and the complexity of your experience. Despite the brain's tendencies to fixate on a handful of bad tiles while overlooking the jewel-like good ones. Create some jewels yourself. Noticing enjoyable or useful thoughts, perceptions, emotions, desires, or actions that are already occurring is the primary way to have a beneficial experience. The experience is here, and it's authentic and real. Why not gain something from it? Additionally, you could create beneficial experiences, such as getting some exercise or thinking about someone who likes you. There are several ways to create these kind of experiences. First, look for good facts. These are the things that support your well-being and welfare, and often that of others. You can find them in many places, including your current situation, recent events, ongoing conditions, the past, and the lives of others. You can also find good facts inside yourself. Consider your talents, skills, and good intentions. You can even find them in hard times, such as seeing the kindness of others as you go through a loss. Second, produce good facts by taking action. For example, you could do something as simple as shifting in a chair to feel more comfortable. Or you could make something good happen in a relationship, such as listening carefully to someone. Facts are facts, and you can count on them. You're not making anything up. Once you have found a good fact, turn the recognition of it into an embodied experience. Know that the fact is really true. Give yourself a sense of conviction about it and trust in it. Be aware of your sensations as you recognize the fact, with a sense of softening and opening in your body. Tune into your feelings and allow the experience to be emotionally rich. And for an extended experience of this, try the experiential practice that we'll be doing soon. Third, directly evoke a positive experience, such as relaxing at will, calling up a sense of determination, or letting go of a resentment. Because of experience-dependent neuroplasticity, repeatedly having and internalizing a particular experience in the past makes it easier and easier to evoke it in the present. It's like being able to push a button on your inner jukebox and quickly get the song of a useful experience playing in your mind since you've recorded it again and again. Whether you're noticing an experience or creating one, each day is full of opportunities to have beneficial thoughts and emotions, perceptions, and desires. Just knowing that this is true is itself a good experience. Experiential practice. Creating a beneficial experience. This practice focuses on gladness, but you can apply the methods in it to any experience you'd like to create for yourself. Think of something, a fact that you are glad about. It could be small or large, in the present or in the past. It could be a thing, an event, an ongoing condition, or a relationship. It could be a spiritual being or the entire universe. Be aware of your body and open to gladness. Gratitude. Comfort. Happiness. There could be an easing of tension, a letting go of stress or disappointment. Explore different elements of the experience. Be aware of thoughts such as, I'm fortunate. Be aware of perceptions, especially body sensations. Be aware of emotions like delight or quiet joy. Recognize desires, perhaps to give thanks. Also be aware of actions, such as a soft smile. Think of other things that you are glad about. Help the knowledge of them to become a rich experience by using the suggestions that I've offered here. Help experiences have lasting value. When you have a good song playing in your mind, turn on the recorder and take it into your brain. Otherwise, it will have little, if any, long-term value. Sometimes there's incidental learning from passing thoughts and feelings, but most of the beneficial experiences that people have in the course of a day make no difference. There is no shift in outlook, no change of heart, no acquisition of inner resources. Much the same happens in psychotherapy, coaching, and human resources programs. As a longtime therapist, it's humbling and haunting to know that most of the hard-won experiences that clients had in my office did not lead to any real change for the better. This was my fault, not theirs. I think that professionals are generally effective at activating various states of mind, but generally poor at installing these as beneficial traits in the brain. Consequently, the greatest opportunity is not in pursuing even better ways for our clients, patients, or students to have useful experiences. It is in getting better at converting the experiences they're already having into durable changes in neural structure and function. Whether you are doing this for yourself or helping someone else, the essence of installation is simple. Enrich the experience and absorb it. In your mind, enriching an experience means keeping it going and feeling it fully, while absorbing it feels like receiving it into yourself. In your brain, enriching is a matter of heightening a particular pattern of mental neural activity, while absorbing involves priming, sensitizing, and increasing the efficiency of the brain's memory-making machinery. This may seem abstract at first, but it's a natural, intuitive process, and we all know how to do it. Everybody has had experiences they've slowed down for and received into themselves. In practice, this process is usually pretty quick, lasting a breath or two, and the enriching and absorbing aspects of it sort of mush together. But when you are learning anything new, including how to learn itself, it's useful to unpack the pieces and focus on each one individually. Then, in the flow of your day, they'll fit back together again as you take in the good as often as you like. Enriching an experience. There are 5 ways to enrich an experience. 1, lengthen it. Stay with it for 5, 10, or more seconds. The longer that neurons fire together, the more they tend to wire together. Protect the experience from distractions. Focus on it and come back to it if your mind wanders. 2, intensify it. Open to it and let it be big in your mind. Turn up the volume, as it were, by breathing more fully or getting a little excited.